enter into a world unseen on Raven Star's Witching Hour. You will encounter eclectic topics from the realm of spirit brought into our matrix of truth. With your host, the Solaris Blue Raven, Solaris will bring you an array of unique guests covering topics from ghostly spirits to amazing anomalies, covert technology, UFOs, and shadowy global events.
And that's right here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, Saturdays, midnight till 2 a.m. Eastern Time. Revolution Radio, where information never sleeps.
Let the magic rise.
Oscar's freeze. That's your cerebral cortex looking for an answer it doesn't have.
See? Even your brain knows you're screwed.
Your body's filling with adrenaline right now, whether you know it or not. Your heart's beating fast. It's getting a little harder to breathe. Your neurobiological system is telling it to run, but your knees are too weak to move.
Fear is not real. The only place that fear can exist is in our thoughts of the future. It is a product of our imagination, causing us to fear things that do not at present and may not ever exist. That is near insanity. And do not misunderstand me. Danger is very real, but fear is a choice. We are all telling ourselves a story.
Listening to Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. 100% listener supported radio. Reporting the danger. Unafraid. Right here, where information never sleeps. Revolution. Radio!
The opinions expressed on this radio station, its programs, and its website by the hosts, guests, and call-in listeners or chatters are solely the opinions of the original source who expressed them. They do not necessarily represent the opinions of Revolution Radio and FreedomSlips.com, its staff, or affiliates.
You're listening to Revolution Radio, FreedomSlips.com, 100% listener-supported radio, and now we return you to your host.
Greetings. It's 3 o'clock in the east and 12 o'clock in the west and 9 o'clock in France, where my co-host Sean O'Nwellen awaits to discuss with us consciousness and his new book on that topic, At the Foundations of Mind. This is your host, Robert Morningstar. I'm very pleased to greet you on this beautiful, beautiful summer day, August 15th, 2021, out of New York City. You are going to hear background sounds that are emanating from a street fair where New Yorkers are back on the streets, acting normal, acting happy, as we should be, and pursuing happiness. I had great pleasure last night of going out to Central Park at about 9:30, 10 o'clock at night, and shooting nature. I'm making a movie. I've been making a movie ever since the COVID pandemic began. And when the lockdown was called, I walked out into the city to do an errand, rode downtown. All of a sudden, I got hungry and I said to myself, well, you know, I'm a little early for this meeting, I think I'll have a pizza. And I realized there was no pizza shop. There was no hot dog stand. There were no restaurants. Everything was closed. Nothing was moving. And I thought, oh, God, what have they done? They've turned New York into a silent town. And so I got the idea of chronicling everything that I've been experiencing with a video diary. And I've been composing a film called The Quiet City, because that is what exactly what it became the first 2 weeks. The only thing you could hear on the streets of New York City were birds. There were no cars. There were no trucks. And the subways weren't running too well. You could only hear birds. And then came the spring and the riots. So it became the Quiet Riot City. And last night I had the pleasure of going out into New York in the middle of the night. And I caught the crowd coming out of Shakespeare in the Park. And it was one of the most beautiful sights I've ever filmed. I walked among the crowd, thousands and thousands of people. No masks, very few masks, I should say, maybe less than 5%, and discarded masks all over the street. So I continued making my film, and I got throngs and throngs. It's a huge parade. I was in the crowd for a while, pardon the expression, shooting the crowd and shooting myself, you know, like selfies. But then I jumped on a bench and just stood there with the camera, and everyone was very happy, waving at the camera, laughing, singing. It wasn't Shakespeare in the Park. There was a huge rock concert. And you may hear something in the background. We're having a street fair here on 92nd Street and Broadway. It goes up to 96th and down to 86th. They close half the avenue so that a normal market can function and people can buy things, sell things, entertain. So there may be some background rock and roll songs in it. So you know that it's not canned music, it's the real point. I've had an amazing week. Before we go on, I would like to say that today we remember Dr. Robin Falkov, who was one of our dear friends and a hostess on Revolution Radio for many years from the beginning. And she passed away a few years ago. Today would have been her birthday, August 25th. And so we remember her, along with all her friends, Kinthea Love, Richard Hoagland, and anyone on Revolution Radio who listened to Revolution Radio knows what a pillar of strength she was for all of us. Dr. Robin Falkov loved Donald Trump. She loved politics. She loved this country. And we remember her very fondly. In the second hour, I may play an interview that she did with Kerry Cassidy so that we can remember not only her memory, but hear her words and remember the great person that she is, because the great persons go on being. While the body dies, the soul goes on, and that you all know what a certainty I have with that. On a personal note, I would like to say that I had a huge surprise this week, thanks to Ancestry.com. I was contacted a few months ago by Ancestry.com and told that I had a niece or a first cousin somewhere in British Columbia. And I contacted the lady, a very fine lady. Her name is Julie. And it turned out that she had suspicions that my father was her father's father. So we got to be friends and we exchanged information. Then earlier this week, I got another notice from Ancestry.com. And this one was a person they designated as a possible first cousin or a sister. And as it turned out, after a couple of days of investigation, August 12th is a day that I will remember for the rest of my life, because I gained a brother, a sister, and a niece as a result of genetic engineering. I think that's what my father was doing, genetic engineering. But I gained a brother, a sister, and a niece to genetic tracing. So it's quite an experience to have. And everyone involved is quite happy, because there was a great mystery as to the identities of our father who art in heaven. God bless him. God rest his soul. So let me turn now on that happy note to another happy fellow, one of my close friends and a great supporter of this program, Sean O'Neillen, who came aboard on D-Day, of all days, to begin a career in radio. D-Day was the day that fate chose. So, Sean, welcome to the program, and I'll turn it over to you to talk, get us started on consciousness.
Okay. First of all, thank you so much, and congratulations, Robert. You're expanding family, my God. And yes. So I want to thank you. I want to thank Revolution Radio and Freedom Slips for giving us the opportunity to speak so at such length about the scamdemic since June the 6th. And tonight we are safe in the knowledge that the battle lines have been drawn. It's very clear that in France right now, there are about 5 million to 10 million people on the streets every Saturday. You're hearing 200,000. So you can safely multiply that by between 20 and 50. Yesterday, there were 5 million people. And it's really, in the United States, it's very clear that nobody is getting vaccinated anymore. So we have done our bit, and we can move on to more elevated thoughts now. And who better to do that with than Robert? And so I have been working on consciousness for basically all my life. And the consciousness area became part of science mainly through quantum mechanics. And in the 1930s, a brilliant Hungarian mathematician called John von Neumann wrote an absolute masterpiece called The Foundations of Quantum Mechanics. This is one of the great books of all time. John von Neumann, by the way, also was very much instrumental in creating the computer. He was part of the Los Alamos atomic bomb project. He was one of the greatest minds of all time. But we're just going to talk about his work on consciousness right now. So basically, quantum mechanics had three links with consciousness, which were extremely close. The first was von Neumann's theorem. So what von Neumann proved basically was that when we're in quantum mechanics and we're talking about the relationship between mind and world, we can move the division between experimenter and world arbitrarily. So let me explain that. It's currently very vague. So when von Neumann started this work in the 1930s, there was this notion that basically some of the instruments being used were still in the classical world, while perhaps the observer was in the quantum world, who knows? And nobody was really quite clear about what was what. So what von Neumann said is that, look, the line between the observer, which is actually going to be couched in classical terms, and the world, which is going to be couched in quantum terms, that can be put anywhere. And why not, he argued, let's go the whole way, and let's put pure consciousness in the classical realm, pure consciousness. And let's have the rest of the entire cosmos be quantum. And this was the foundations of quantum mechanics. 1930s, nobody has refuted this. It's still out there. Those of you who are into non-dualism, Advaita Vedanta, and Francis Lucille, people like that, those are the theorems that Francis Lucille uses. So we had this immediate link with conscious observation and quantum mechanics. And then we found that there were two other links in quantum mechanics. One was the fact that the twin slits experiment shows that in some way, external reality responds to probing by the investigator, that basically external reality conforms to questions being asked by the observer. This was mind-boggling for people when it happened. And most of you know this. For Richard Feynman, this was the only mystery in quantum mechanics. It still remained a mystery. And again, you can't actually really gainsay this. You have to say that in some way, external, so-called external reality must be noetic. It must be related to knowledge in some way. We don't understand that yet, and we're really still struggling with it. The third relationship between consciousness and quantum mechanics was quantum entanglement. So essentially, if two particles become quantum entangled at any stage, they are quantum entangled forever. Now, this originally is due to a paper in 1935 by Einstein, Podolsky, and Rosen, the EPR paper. And Einstein really did not like the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanics. So he decided to write a paper which, using a reductio ad absurdum argument, undermined quantum mechanics forever. So the EPR paper, as it's called, Einstein, Podolsky, Rosen paper, said that, look, if you've got two particles and they interact in quantum mechanics terms and you put them at opposite ends of the cosmos, then they're still going to be communicating with each other. And that obviously can't happen because it's going to contradict relativity theory. And this was the EPR paper in 1935. And it was regarded as, it was basically meant to be a reductio ad absurdum, a mockery of quantum mechanics. And in the 1960s, an Irish physicist working in the CERN facility in Switzerland called John Stuart Bell produced what he called Bell's inequalities and basically said that, well, under what conditions could that circumstance actually occur? Shortly afterwards, Alan Aspect and other researchers proved in actual fact that the situation that Einstein thought was totally absurd actually was the way nature worked. So quantum entanglement is the law. So we've got three things already, quantum mechanics and consciousness. We've got from the twin slits experiments, we've got the notion that the nature responds to thought, that it responds to observation, and that was mind-boggling and still is. We've got John von Neumann's work saying that if you've got an experimenter looking at a quantum system, that the line between observer and apparatus can be placed anywhere. It can be placed at the physical person of the observer. It can be placed at the eye. It can be placed perhaps at the limits of the apparatus. Alternatively, you can decide that what's on the classical side is pure consciousness itself and everything else is quantum and on the other side. And it's as miraculous as that, folks. The third situation where we had some kind of relationship with consciousness was entanglement. And this indicated that reality is vehemently interconnected. It's this absolute mess of interconnected things and that they are passing influences to each other instantaneously. So the speed of light is not actually the law here. The influences are passed instantaneously. Note that I say influences, I don't say signals, because signals means that there's a message that you want to communicate. So before I get into neuroscience, I want to just take a break there and see if Robert wants to, in Socratic fashion, draw me out on any of these things, because we want to get into the neuroscience and understand that a little bit now.
Yeah. Well, you've mentioned two names and the associations that come up, because I really do want to deal with consciousness and the alterations of consciousness that we are experiencing right now, mass mind, you might say. But two names struck me, and they resonate with me. One of them is Einstein and Rosen, and the other one is John von Neumann. And both of these are resonating with me on the plane of extraterrestrial influences on our consciousness. And of course, Einstein, I assume it's the same Rosen as the Einstein-Rosen bridge. He worked closely with Mr. Rosen, Professor Rosen. Einstein had an idea that Einstein-Rosen bridges, wormholes could be created between two regions of the universe that would make it possible to traverse from point A to point B without crossing the space of a sea between them. And then John von Neumann is important in my work in ufology because in 1947-48, he came up with a theory that mankind arriving at the atomic age and the radio age had awakened something. And what he hypothesized was something called the von Neumann probes, which is machinery left scattered throughout the universe by a sentient race that came by and went on, but left modules resting, buried, or submerged, that when the time came for mankind to break through into radio transmissions or nuclear energy, they would be tripped and become factories to manufacture something based on artificial intelligence. So that's where your introduction is leading me, and I hope that at the later part of the program, I'm turning it back to you, we'll get into how extraterrestrial influences have molded human consciousness and are perhaps even doing it right now through genetic engineering. So back to you, Sean.
So it's important that people realize that what we're hearing now about artificial intelligence and the singularity is the moment at which artificial intelligence decides really it doesn't need us anymore, that all of that was anticipated by John von Neumann, and that the singularity is actually his idea. It's actually not Google's idea. It's actually an idea from John von Neumann. To continue on your correctly chosen ideas about extraterrestrial and other influences, the fact is that there are working batteries from Iraq in prehistoric times. Nobody doubts that these exist. Nobody doubts that the level of engineering in the pyramids and these other massive architectural projects is still way ahead of anything we can do today in terms of stone cutting. Just imagine what if you wanted people to build a pyramid today, what you would have to do. Basically, the cost is about $2 billion, but it would not ever happen in any case. Something like that is really too perfect and the standards are too high. So basically, let's getting back to Einstein and Rosen. So we have a common friend called Jack Sarfati, and yes. Jack, one of his major equations is EPR equals ER, that the Einstein-Podolsky-Rosen equals Einstein-Rosen, that basically because of this entanglement, we have the possibility of wormholes. I'm not really going to pursue that myself. I think we could probably get Jack on the program to talk about that because he's well able to talk. So with your permission, Robert, I will now head into some neuroscience.
Yes, indeed. Also, I would like to mention, you know, I do want to discuss the holographic theory of mind, because a lot of people think that everything they're seeing is outside themselves, and I want to straighten that out. Like, it's kind of a shocking thing for people to hear me speaking on the holographic nature of human perception. So maybe we'll get there a little bit later, but by all means, let's go into neuroscience.
We will indeed. We're actually going to get to the holographic theory of mind through neuroscience, and I am very unusual in that I had the great privilege of working not just with Walter Freeman III, but with Carl Pribram. Carl was my very good friend, and so he is the guy who produced this theory in the first place. We will indeed get there. I want to tell people that everything that I'm about to talk about has been peer-reviewed. And published, so I've collected all the papers on a website called bionoetics.org, B-I-O-N-O-E-T-I-C-S.org, B bionoetics.org. And you can find literally hundreds of papers there. But what I'm about to talk about, you can find published in my name. So I had the great privilege of working with Walter Freeman III, the son of Walter Freeman II, who was a notorious lobotomist, lobotomized Rosemary Kennedy and basically ended her life. And his son at that time was working in the Navy, had a pretty checkered start to his career. His father suggested that since Walter III was obviously a talented engineer, why not try and use engineering techniques on the brain so he wouldn't have to lobotomize people to control them? And that was the, it's important that people realize that essentially lobotomies in the 1940s and 1950s were what graphene and 5G are for today. They were basically a way of controlling people. And they did it then in the name of mental illness. Now they do it because they think they can. And my view is they can't. But let's keep going for a second. Now, I worked with some very, very close to the bone data. So when people are undergoing surgery for epilepsy, they often have the option of signing a form offering their data. So essentially what you do is you go deep into the brain with electrodes and you collect data. You collect data, you sample it at whatever speed is available to your technology at the time. So we had data that was collected in Washington around 2000 of an epileptic patient who was undergoing surgery. That meant that the data are basically the hardcore. It's basically neural impulses deep in the brain, and we have them under conditions of sleep, awake, doing a task, and seizure. And I was uncomfortable with using these data, needless to say. So we decided, let's try and find a way of working out how to do simulations as well. So in any case, we published many papers on this. You can find Walter Freeman and myself. That's N-U-A-L-L-A-I-N, N-U-A-L-L-A-I-N. And you can find a lot of papers that I wrote subsequent to this on consciousness and meditation. So essentially what we found in the paradigm we were using is that several times a second, the brain gets into a state where it's consuming essentially zero energy. This is extraordinary, but it's actually true. Now, normally you are consuming the energy of a 100 watt bulb. You are this 100 watt bulb walking around the world at the moment, or sitting down as you're doing right now. And your brain is consuming 20% of that energy. So you're a 100 watt bulb and the brain is 20 watts. And now it gets really interesting, because several times a second in a normal functioning brain, the rate of consumption goes down to something very, very close to zero. Now, we had a good look at this. We found that in these what we call null states of the brain, there was a phase transition. So that's something similar. A phase transition is something similar from the transition from water to ice or from water to steam. There was a phase transition and the brain completely changed state. And when a stimulus emerged, when a stimulus was presented to the brain, it would go through three of these phase transitions consecutively. So our consciousness is based on this miraculous ability of the brain to, in this massive system of around 100 billion neurons, to orchestrate this total change of state in milliseconds from one state to another. Now, When we continued to examine this, we found that there are certain types of brainwaves with certain characteristics. So the brainwaves, which most of you will have heard of, are theta, delta, beta, and gamma. And beta and gamma are the higher frequencies. So gamma is characteristically thought of as between 40 and 80 hertz. Now it's about to get absolutely fascinating, folks, because the signature, that which characterizes meditation and consciousness, is gamma waves synchronized over major parts of the cortex. And let me repeat that. So basically, when you are meditating successfully, or when you are in a state of flow in consciousness, we find that your brain is synchronized, that the phase of the waves is synchronized, and there is a signature of around 80 hertz pretty much everywhere in your brain. This is absolutely remarkable, but true. So we found this in the real data we had, which we derived from somebody's brain, and we were able to work out simulations so we didn't ever have to do surgery like this again on anybody. But it's now about to get really, really more interesting, because at the time that we were writing in 2007, all the work by Davidson and Kabat-Zinn and all these people was getting an awful lot of traction. So it was basically about how the signature of meditation in Tibetan monks was a high synchronized gamma. And this was one of the great findings of all time in neuroscience, that they found that gamma of an amplitude and of a synchrony never discovered before was actually present in Tibetan monks who were doing meditation. And not only that, but as Kabat-Zinn has successfully made a career out of proving, that meditation is extremely good for you. Meditation thickens your cortex, it lowers your blood pressure, it improves your health. It's one of the best things you could possibly do. So what we surmised, and I published several papers on this, what we surmised then, concluded, was that the reason that meditation is so good for you is that when you have synchronized gamma superimposed on the random firing of cells, neurons in the brain, that the energy demand by the brain on the total organism, which is usually around 20 watts, it goes down to close to zero. And it stays there. It actually sustains this zero demand for up to seconds at a time. I published this originally in a paper called Zero Power and Selflessness, What Meditation and Conscious Perception Have in Common. And it's in numerous other papers that I've published since then. About the best of them is one called Consciousness is Cheap. And so we have an absolutely enormous finding here. And I'm going to just summarize this and then get back to Robert. So essentially what we did was we were able ultimately to simulate, without doing any brain surgery, we were able to simulate neural firing as essentially what's called white noise, the random firing of neurons. And there are present in each brain, there are alpha, theta, beta and gamma waves. There are other waves, but we're not going to get into those for the moment. But it's gamma that is actually very much related to consciousness. It's gamma waves, and particularly gamma waves synchronized in phase over large areas of the cortex. And what we found is that when you have gamma waves synchronized over large areas of the cortex like that, the energy demand of the brain on the organism, which is usually 20 watts on an organism which is consuming 100 watts, that goes down four orders of magnitude. And that essentially what meditation is a discontinuous but nevertheless present feeling of subjectivity being enhanced as the state that Krishnamurti talks about, the state that conscious observation, conscious choiceless observation is freedom, that is your state. So that was for the first time backed up by some very hard neuroscientific evidence. And we published this in various journals, from the Journal of Integrative Neuroscience to Biosemiotics to Cognitive Sciences. And that work finished, unfortunately, when Walter passed away in 2016. I'm ready for Robert to come back to me with some questions, and we can then get into holographic.
I'm musing on so many of the names that you've mentioned, and so much I learned from all of them. And now the latest one you mentioned is Krishnamurti. And I had the privilege of sitting in Carnegie Hall and learning absolute stillness from Krishnamurti. I went there with a friend, the same friend who introduced me to Tai Chi Chuan and Kung Fu. We joined together. His name is Alex. And he was actually a Buddhist monk, and a real one. He went to Japan to study Buddhism, and was in a Buddhist monastery in Japan. So he told me about Krishnamurti, and I've been hearing a lot about him. For those of you who don't know, Krishnamurti was being groomed very early in his life to be presented to the Western world as the second coming of Christ, or the Messiah. He was a very, very gifted and highly spiritual individual, young boy from India. But as time went on, he realized what was being done with his image, and he said, no, it's not me, I'm not the Messiah, I'm not the second coming of Christ, but I do have something to teach. And he taught meditation. And I sat in Carnegie Hall, and I was amazed. I learned how to sit like Krishnamurti by imitating him. There was only a chair on the stage, simple chair, fold-up chair. He sat down, he put his hands on his laps, and he sat there like a little Egyptian pharaoh for three and a half hours, and nothing moved except his lips. And he imbued me with a sense of calm and stillness, which I can still return to when it's necessary. I'm also a very, as you know, a very animated and very vocal. But there are moments when we need to really, as the Sioux Indians say, hold your seat. You know, when you get a little bit scattered, nervous, shaken up, the Sioux Indians at ceremonies with peyote say the brave has to learn how to hold his seat. So they'll tell you, you know, to get yourself under control, hey man, hold your seat. So I'm holding my seat right now and musing on that. The other thing is this thing about vibrations. We were talking about expansion of consciousness. Everyone has heard that term. You had the privilege of working with those great scientists and surgeons. I had the great privilege of working with Timothy Leary in the front seat of my car as I drove him home after a lecture. And as I've said a couple of times on this program, the most important lecture that I ever heard Timothy Leary give was one called Learn How to Operate Your Brain, Because If You Don't, Someone Else Will. And on this next note about the frequencies, the Russians did really diabolical studies on the effects of different frequencies on the human mind and the human body. And they were trying to develop ways of incapacitating people, also ways of strengthening the mind or weakening the mind. And the Russians found that in the low hertz frequencies, that if a person was constantly exposed to a frequency of 5 to 6.5 hertz, very deep depression would fall upon that person. They did this by putting people in rooms and filming them, leaving the room and just turning on basically subaudible sound, 5 to 6.5 hertz. Then they found that if the frequency was raised to 7 or 7.5 hertz, the person would feel extremely happy, joyful, happy without reason. If that frequency was raised to 8 or 9, a certain anxiety would ensue. And beyond 9, 10, 11, and 12, absolute frenzy would be the result. Now, it is a coincidence, interesting coincidence, sad one, that when the Schumann resonance, the Schumann resonance is a wave of energy that's always resonating through on the earth, between the earth and the ionosphere. It's caused by lightning strikes. There are about 50 million lightning strikes a day, and this creates a resonance between the surface of the earth and the ionosphere, and this frequency is the result. It's called the Schumann resonance. And when it was discovered, it was precisely 7.5 hertz, which means that Earth was going through a pretty happy time at that time. The Earthlings bathing in the Schumann resonance were bathing in a 7.5 hertz, which is the frequency of general happiness. And over the years since that time, this was 1970s, mid-70s, this was discovered, the Schumann resonance has increased and increased and increased. And now it stands up there around 12, the last time I checked. So I see this as a consequence of all of this high technology, high electronic technology, microwave technologies, communication satellites, nuclear devices, microwave communications. So this feeling of malaise, you might say, not feeling just quite right with yourself, could be due to an oversaturation of our environment with these frequency. Last thing I'll mention is earlier this week, I received a call from a friend of mine who is not just a contactee. She believes that she is a downloaded extraterrestrial in a human body who is here to try to help mankind and save mankind from evil aliens who are here to destroy us and to enslave the remnant. She was very excited because some fellow in Canada had started doing brain studies and resonance studies with individuals, normal people, as we'll call them, and also people who have had direct contact with extraterrestrials, and those who, like himself and this lady, believe that they are alien entities incarnate right now on this planet, trying to help mankind elevate ourselves and escape the clutches of evil aliens who are here to change our brains, change our nature, enslave the remnant after they've wiped out a large segment of the population. And she said that this researcher claimed to have found frequencies in the alien types of up to 10,000 hertz, which is a pretty high frequency, I must say. As far as high frequencies are concerned, I have to say that I said I studied with Timothy Leary. I knew him personally. I believed in his work. I was doing my college work for my degree in psychology in the midst of the psychedelic era, the psychedelic revolution. And most of the experiments and voyages that I took began when it was perfectly legal. It was perfectly legal to explore your own mind. My first experience was with mescaline after reading Huxley's book, The Doors of Perception. And then I was initiated by the Native American Church of the Lakota Sioux, became a member of that in 1971. And I was initiated into the Native American Church, which believes in something called the Peyote Christ. They believe that when they eat peyote, it brings them closer to God, and very often you will have Christic experiences under the influence of peyote. And of course, there's LSD and several other psychedelics. I have not done ayahuasca, which seems to be a very powerful thing. I did sit through a lecture with Graham Hancock, who told us about his experiences in South America with ayahuasca, and coincidentally showed us his diary projected up on the screen with amazing drawings. It seems that people who do ayahuasca have a very direct confrontation with the spirit of life on this planet. Some people have experienced communications with blue whales. Others regularly encounter a giant snake. It was called Naga in India. And Graham Hancock actually encountered an extraterrestrial, a typical gray alien, and he drew him. He drew a wonderful illustration of this gray alien. While everyone was mesmerized by the face of the alien on the screen, I was started to read the diary, and he only showed one page, unfortunately. But I remember that he said that the alien was just staring at him quietly and staring at him in such a way that he got the impression that the alien did not approve of him, Graham Hancock. Well, contrary to alien opinion, I do hold Graham Hancock in great esteem. I think he's one of the great geniuses of our time. And his books, especially Fingerprints of the Gods, is well. So let me lay that on the table for you to dissect. And back to Sean.
So interesting that you say that these aliens want to change our nature and fiddle around with our minds. But that's exactly what the World Economic Forum and Bill Gates and the World Health Organization are trying to do at the moment with graphene and these clot shots, which are genetically modified and are really intended to sterilize people, but most people have wised up to that now. So yes. I want to elevate things, and let's stop being warriors for a second, and let's be scientists and lovers and things like that. And we'll talk about Karl Pribram. So Pribram was originally Hungarian, came to the United States quite early, and came to Dublin to a conference I organized in 1999, which had Stuart Hameroff, Bernard Barres, David Galen, many others. It was a fantastic conference. And the Pribram started working with one of my PhD students at the time, who was from County Clare, like me and like Mr. Constantine, who was one of Robert's teachers. And yes. Pribram basically did a brain dump to Tom Doris over 2 days where they toured Dublin together. So we did the only computational implementation of Pribram's work. It still to this day is the only computational implementation of it. So Pribram basically argued as follows. He says that all this stuff, Hubel, Wiesel, and so on, claiming that the human brain processes blobs and angles and corners and produces a representation, he said that all of that is nonsense. It presumes way too much. All we do is something like a Fourier transform or a Gabor transform. There's no structure out there for us to work on. So what we did then is we produced a computer implementation of that in C++ and went on to do it in MATLAB. And that became the content of a course that I taught at Stanford for credit in 2006 called Neuroscience and Experience. Now let's talk about the holographic idea that Pribram had. Ironically, he was much more bought into a holonomic idea, which is this kind of idea that every perception you have is in the context of literally billions of other perceptions, and you have to consider all of these while you're trying to understand that single perception. And that was itself quite powerful. But he did at many moments get into a holographic idea, which is that basically our action is a kind of reference beam, which is shone over an undifferentiated Ouroboros, this kind of mess of the sensorium. And from that, we intuit the world that we inhabit. So let me put that in clearer English. So essentially, he argued all the time that all we have out there is a mess of frequencies. What's out there in the external world is not something structured. It's just mess of frequencies. And he argued that our action basically works like a laser. And our action and our perception works like a laser in making sense of this mess of frequencies and giving to us something meaningful at the end. So this is basically, in a nutshell, the holographic idea of Pribram. Now, it probably is correct in some sense. Something like that is probably closest to how we interpret reality. And it does seem to be the case that reality is enfolded in itself such that every single part of it can reveal the whole. We are struggling now. We were struggling when I talked about quantum mechanics earlier. We haven't really come to the end of that line of thinking in human experience yet. And with respect to holography and meaning, no, we're not even starting. And none of the money in research is going into that. And as I repeat this, to this day, my group in Dublin is the only group ever to do a computational implementation of Carl Pribram's work. And I did get a Spanish guy to translate that from C++ into MATLAB, but that's it. So over to Robert.
Well, you know, there is a missing person in this whole argument, and I've been missing him. You keep talking about Pribram, but the theory is called the Pribram-Boehm theory. David Boehm, let's remember him. That's how I came upon the theory of the holographic mind. David Boehm wrote something called The Implicate Order, which is, I would say, it's a companion work to what you cited and to the work of Pribram.
And Boehm was also very close to Jiddu Krishnamurti, and we can in fact with safely spend some time talking about these guys. We've just had a year and a half of our life taken by a bunch of imbeciles. And please, Robert, let us elevate the discourse.
Yes. Well, here's my point. You used a wonderful word, the sensorium. That's a beautiful expression for everything outside of us. And so in terms of neuroscience, you know, I have done a lot of work on my own brain. It's because I took his advice. Learn how to operate my brain or else somebody else will. And Pribram-Boehm theory really struck me deeply because I realized what the gurus and the yogis meant by saying that everything is an illusion. Everything you see is an illusion. The illusion is that it is outside ourselves. So I'd like to shock a couple of people and tell you everything you're hearing right now, everything you're seeing, that computer in front of you, is not outside yourself. Take your hand and put it on the back of your head. Touch the back of your head. You are touching the region of the optic lobe. That computer, my voice, your perceptions of reality, the air around you, the sunlight coming in the window, that's all in the back of your head. It's being projected into a little room called the optic lobe. Two sensors called our eyes crisscross. They take the input of the sensorium, the visual input, they cross it at the optic chiasma, right at your third eye, and then they feed it into the back of your head, where it is projected in this little room called the optic lobe. As those perceptions or that sensory perception goes through, it's filtered. There are two bodies in the brain called the lateral geniculate. And these two bodies, little nodes inside your brain, compare the right side and the left side to each other and then present to you the sameness. The sameness is presented to you. And so this is how we see. And some people get really a little upset with this idea, but you have to realize that everything you see is being projected. It's not outside yourself. And what does that make of the universe? Everything you perceive of the universe is really inside you. And with that comes a power to interact with it on another level, a different modality. And in the beginning, Sean talked about the dual slit experiment. And quantum mechanics also tells us that observing reality changes it. So we have not yet fathomed the prospect that we have the ability to change reality through our interaction with it. And this is where we come to the Tai Chi concept of to think is to create, imagination becomes reality. I was told by Tai Chi masters in their thinking that one eye projects and one eye receives. That one eye is receiving the information and another one is projecting a beam. It's kind of like the laser beam idea. There's a laser coming out of our heads, out of our brains, and imposing order or disorder on the sensorium. So let me, we have 1 minute left. I'll give it to you until we have the music break, and then we'll continue after the hour, after the break. Sean.
So what I would like to talk about after the break is, on the one hand, quantum field theory and the work of Freeman and Vitiello. And on the other hand, basically God. We have not talked enough about God. We need him.
I agree. So, I am anticipating the sound, the dulcet sounds of the Revolution Radio break, but if we're not going to have it, we can just keep going until it stops. I hear it.
Hear it?
I hear a little rumbling in the background there. It's squirting out. Here it comes. Let's give a big hand to Mr. Rowe, our engineer. It was great with you.
Thank you for listening to Revolution Radio.
We're an anarcho-syndicalist commune. We take it in turns to act as a sort of executive officer for the week.
Yes.
But all the decisions of that officer have to be ratified at a special bi-weekly meeting.
Yes, I see.
By a simple majority in the case of purely internal affairs.
Be quiet.
But by a two-thirds majority in the case of more...
Be quiet.
I order you to be quiet.
Look, you stupid bastard. You've got no arms left.
Yes, I have. Look.
It's just a flesh wound.
I don't believe I'm seen such a display of courage, skill, nerve, grace, and stupidity.
I'll do you for that.
What?
Come here.
What are you going to do, bleed on me?
I'm invincible.
You're a loony.
The Black Knight always triumphs.
Roundtable Live, Monday through Friday, 1 a.m. till 4 a.m. Eastern Time. Bring your mind, bring your ideas, bring your voice. King Arthur had nothing on us. Here, Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com.
Hi, everybody. It's me, the Fetch, host of Inside the Eye Live. Before the Sunday mainstream media political pundit talk shows, there is Inside the Eye Live, where we break down some of the weekly mainstream media talking points before the talking points even get aired. Add in some entertaining stories, weather, cats, intriguing and informative guests, and you get one of the most listened to Saturday morning streaming media political talk shows going today. And it's all all right here on our flagship station, Revolution Radio at freedomslips.com. So join me, the Fetch, for Inside the Eye Live every Saturday morning at 10 o'clock a.m. Eastern. It is truly intelligent media for the politically aware.
This is Thomas, a.k.a. a Mad Painter. I'd like you to join me Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern Standard Time for Open Canvas. Don't forget to bring an open mind.
Yes, folks, that's right. Bring an open mind to an open canvas. Again, that is Monday nights, 10 p.m. Eastern. UFOs to government corruption. This is Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. You don't need to expect us. We're already here.
Many years from now, would you be willing to trade all the days from this day to that for one chance, just one chance, to come back here and tell our enemies that they may take our lives, but they'll never take our freedom?
The future is uncertain. I know this. Death is inevitable. I know this. But one thing is certain, as free men, it is our right to live unencumbered and in peace. And those times are quickly drawing to an end. And in these times, peace is certainly an illusion. And as the chains grow tighter, our ability to slip those chains increase incrementally with every passing moment. Inaction is no longer an option. It's time to raise our voices like a cacophony of thunder and lightning and tell the masters no more. And this is Nighthawk, and I say, for myself, no more. Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com, because the freedom is slipping away.
All right, thanks for listening while we took that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.
It's 4:02 in the east, 1:02 in the west, 10:02 in France, where people are fighting for their freedoms. As we are doing so here on freedomslips.com, Revolution Radio. And I ask the audience at this time to please contribute to Revolution Radio to help Revolution Radio continue on its mission of bringing truth, justice, and the American way back to America. But folks, a large segment of our population has lost the way, Also, I'd like to ask you to contribute to the Morningstar Report. You can make a tax-deductible donation via PayPal. We have a tax-exempt organization called globalpeacemedia.org. globalpeacemedia.org/TheMorningstarReport. One word, themorningstarreport.html. And we would appreciate any help that you can give us. We have had some very kind and wonderful friends who have been donating and have made it possible for us to continue. So please contribute to Revolution Radio via freedomslips.com or revolution.radio. And to the Morning Star Report, which includes the Right Stuff radio show on Mondays and the Flash Gordon Radio Club, through globalpeacemedia.org/themorningstarreport.html. I know it's a lot to remember, but we memorized the times table, didn't we? Anyway, thank you for being with us. This is a fascinating dissertation and discussion with my co-host, Sean O'Merlin, and the subject is consciousness. I would like to just throw into the mix my belief that water is conscious and that oxygen is the agent of consciousness, and that oxygen and water intermingle to produce something called living water. And living water houses the soul, and that the soul and this living water wears the human body as an apparatus, like a diver has to wear the scuba gear, or deep divers have to wear the hard helmet and the insulated suits, just like astronauts, to be able to function in alien atmospheres. So I came to the conclusion long ago that water is conscious, oxygen is the agent of consciousness, because when our brains are deprived of oxygen, where do we go? We go away. If we get the oxygen back, we come back. But that's some of my theories. And those, you can call that metaphysics. This is exploring the boundary layer between matter, mind, and soul and spirit. I would like to remind Sean that a couple of weeks ago, our friend Jack Sarfati shared a document with us. It was an unclassified or declassified document from the CIA discussing remote viewing, ways of achieving it, and the different states of consciousness and methods for achieving it. And one of the most intriguing ones dealt with meditation and how, in order to remote view, the right side of the brain, the right side mind, has to be allowed to expand. And it expands when you're able to shut down the left side. The left side is the verbal center. All our chit-chat, all our internal dialogues, those are being generated by two areas of the brain, the Wernicke bodies and the Brodmann areas of the left side of the brain. And that is what produces the incessant conversationalists. And one of the first stages of arriving at meditation is to shut down the incessant conversationalist. And it's actually disciplining yourself, your mind, your brain, to just stop talking and to start experiencing. But the interesting thing was that it said that one of the things the CIA had discovered was that in meditation, a certain sound wave would be generated and become a standing wave in the third ventricle. That's one of the hollow areas, not quite hollow because it's full of cerebrospinal fluid, but that this vibration of this sound in the third ventricle induced a state of higher consciousness, according to Kundalini Yoga. And the other one, which was equally intriguing, was that the heartbeat is generating a pulse, and that this pulse travels down the aorta, and it hits bottom where the aorta bifurcates into the femoral arteries that go into the legs, and there's a bounce back, and that these two sounds, the descending sound from the aorta pumping the blood down, and the hitting the bottom, it goes back up and goes straight up and can go into the brain. And when you get into a very harmonic state with this as another standing wave, it induces this other state of consciousness, which makes it possible to experience remote viewing. So I'd just like to bring that back. I don't know if you got to read the paper, but it is really fascinating. The third element was hypnosis, and fourth element was biofeedback. So biofeedback, we interaction with an apparatus. We can learn to control certain body functions, like working with a thermometer, holding it in your hand and trying to lower the temperature on the thermometer. That involved biofeedback and various ways that they've developed now to enhance that capacity. So we have ways of controlling our own minds, our own brainwave functions, but we also have brainwaves that can emanate from us and alter reality. So I'll turn it over to Sean on that note and see how we arrive at God.
So let's actually start from some basic things. First of all, please, folks, support Robert. Please support his programs. I'm a volunteer. I'm happy to do this. Robert has played an immense role in the dialogue about the scamdemic since June the 6th when we started. And we have got a lot of truth out there. And we've got to the point where we're now comfortable about talking about more abstract things, because the battle lines are drawn and it's pretty clear they can't get away with this. And there will be blood on the streets if they try. And let us all pray there will not be blood on the streets. I will just say in Marseille, in France yesterday, they put a whole bunch of agents provocateurs out on the streets. I've been criticized for my language on this program before, but I will say in France that in French that the crowd yelled cassez-vous at the agent provocateur. You can find this on BitChute. I have not broken a single American law about obscenity. And that essentially it's very clear at this point that what should have been a scientific issue is now being dealt with out on the streets because the scientists reneged on what they were meant to do. And consequently, it's been up to Robert to walk the tightrope since June the 6th, when he invited me on this program, of letting me talk freely about what was really going on. And having said all that, let us move on to two points that he made. So the first thing is talking about God. Well, I'm going to leave God aside just for a second, and let's just return to the holographic idea and brainwaves for a moment. So what we concluded as a result of our work on brainwaves with both Priveran and Freeman, and I know a lot of people who listen to this program are very technically good. So some of you will not get this, but a lot of you will. So essentially, we believe that the holographic idea may have a lot of validity. And what we used was a concept from John Hopfield called content addressable associative memory. So if I say, for example, shall I compare D to a, you will remember the first line, shall I compare thee to a summer's day? And so I evoked the whole content by using a part of the content. So that's content associative. Now, what we think is that in for consciousness to emerge, that the sensorium must be processed by theta, delta, gamma, beta, possibly high gamma, which is much more than 80 hertz, and possibly other lower frequency waves like mu. It must be processed by all of those at the same time. So essentially, for a conscious thing to remain in memory, it must have the capacity that a really sketchy version of that thing, basically, shall the compare, okay, that something like that will be able to evoke the whole line. And so we have something like a holograph here, which has basically been implemented by the fact that, as Walter Freeman proved, that all these theta, gamma, delta, alpha, and so on, all of these are fractal. They have a fractal characteristic. If you take gamma and you spread it out over 16 seconds, it will look just like alpha if you spread it out over, I think it's 4 seconds. In any case, it's there on the papers that we published. So we have a fractal nature happening here. And the fractal nature is what allows the brain to switch between states so suddenly. And so I want to hand over to Robert for a second, because what I've been saying is that the holographic theory, the holographic sensorium is actually possibly implemented by the fact that gamma, delta, theta, alpha, and so on waves, that essentially they are self-similar, they are fractal. And that is why our perception of the cosmos is fractal.
My mic is stuck. My mic was stuck.
And holographic. It's fractal. It's fractal and yes. Therefore holographic.
Yes, I'm back. I'm back. The mic was, I muted so that the band and the street is less audible. They're having a party out there and it's a really nice party. But yes, the universe is fractal and we compose it. Every perception that we have is an individually manufactured perception. No two people see the same thing exactly alike. It's impossible. We'd have to be sitting inside each other to look through the same two eyes to have the same point of view.
I'm just going to interrupt you for a second, Robert, but I think you will enjoy the interruption. So what you talk about water is a dipole. So that basically means that the oxygen is very far away from the two hydrogens. And that it's H2O. And the essentially what brain function depends on is what's called spontaneous symmetry breaking, where the dipole undergoes a symmetry break. And it is this symmetry break that turns the information arriving at the cortex into meaning. Now, those of you who haven't gotten this, which is basically 100% of you, don't worry about it. There are papers available free on the web. One name to remember is Vitiello, V-I-T-I-E-L-L-O. V-I-T-I-E-L-L-O. I've mentioned his name before. Giuseppe Vitiello, who worked with Walter Freeman. So there are two papers in particular you should look at. Matter, Mind, and Consciousness by Giuseppe Vitiello, which just came out last year, and Matter and Mind Entangled by Vitiello and Freeman. So Robert's idea that water is absolutely crucial to consciousness and who we are is central to both those papers. So basically, we are, in terms of molecules, we're 90% water. In terms of weight, it's just 70% because water is a relatively light molecule. But in any event, everything that happens in our brains and bodies is completely rooted in water. Robert.
Which is a perfect conductor, actually. And I think in terms of all those waves, you know, the confusion in the human mind is a conflict of those waves. When we have a steady state, you know, alpha, beta, theta, gamma. But when there's a conflict between waves, we can have two kinds of interference between waves, destructive interference and constructive interference. An analogy has been used in the past to demonstrate this idea. Imagine a very long curtain and two people at either end of the curtain, and the people start to wave the curtain. And with a certain coordination, the two people can wave the curtain in synchrony and amplify the waves so they grow bigger and bigger and bigger. But there's another way in which one person can thwart the other person's intention, generate a wave and then a counter wave, and then the clashes will occur. And I feel that a lot of emotional conflict and mental conflicts are the result of these clashing waves, because people don't know how to think anymore. They don't know what to believe. And the result is confusion. And confusion results in something called cognitive dissonance, when you are presented with two opposite concepts and both are presented to you as true, which is, I feel, most of the world has been suffering for quite a long time now.
18 months at least. 18 months. It's been indoctrinated into us at a level that neither of us imagined we would ever see in our lifetimes.
Yes, indeed. But for me, it began far, far longer ago. The use of cognitive dissonance to control a population for me began with the John F. Kennedy assassination and the generation of conspiracy theory concepts by the CIA, the Operation Mockingbird, and of course MKUltra. We have become MKUltrified. They perfected their techniques of mass deception in the United States in the aftermath of President Kennedy's death. By lying about everything, folks. They lied about the physics of the magic bullet. They lied about the identity of Lee Harvey Oswald. They lied about the autopsy. They lied about the brain. They lied about law. They lied about everything. And that is where, that's the bifurcation in science. That's when anti-science was born. The government embraced fake science as a useful instrument to control people politically and control, term I hate to use, the masses, to control the citizenry. And that's what we're battling. We're battling to destroy that system. Dr. Fauci is an anti-scientist. Dr. Collins of the FDA, he's an anti-scientist. These, and let me not forget the director, Walensky of the CDC, who is manipulating information daily to keep you confused and frightened. Science should never frighten people. Science is a vehicle for liberation, for freedom, to extract yourself from doubt and superstition. And unfortunately, the powers that be, as we call them, the Illuminati, the Bilderbergers, the Freemasons, whatever name, whatever label you want to put on them, the Ku Klux Klan, they all use false doctrines and fake science to goad you, to cow you. You know, to cow, it's an interesting thing that vaccine and vaccinate come from the word cow, lavash, right? So to be vaccinated is basically to be cowed, to be turned into a cow. And that's why I haven't had a shot since 1972, when I had to take a gamma globulin shot because I was going to Europe, my first trip to Europe. I've never had a shot after that, and I do not intend to take the clot shot. So
there is a rather brilliant biologist called Jonathan Rappaport, and he is the guy who actually originally invented the term fake news. But Jonathan Rappaport, so you're American, so you can spell Rappaport. There are a lot of Rappaports in America. So Rappaport, in a few months ago, he's a nerd. I mean, he's worse than I am. He actually reads this stuff. So most of the really, really critical information about SARS-CoV-2 and COVID-19, proving that the whole thing is a farce and the greatest crime in history. Most of the evidence comes from the CDC and the FDA's own documents. So he's a braver man than me. And he went through the FDA's analysis of the Pfizer evidence. So the Pfizer evidence that led them to get emergency use authorization for their clot shot. And he pointed out that actually to get emergency use authorization, you need the efficacy of the injection to be greater than 50%. That means that if you've got 1,000 people who are not vaccinated and who get the infection, you need at least 1,500 who get the injection and don't get it. And he made the point, it's nowhere near 50%, and the Pfizer clot shot should never have gotten emergency use authorization. Now, folks, if you think we're just two old hippies spinning our wheels here, go and read the stuff yourself. So the CDC declared several weeks ago that the PCR test basically is nothing. It is essentially a whole bunch of random RNA viruses and nothing to do with SARS-CoV-2 or COVID-19. That's the CDC. And now the FDA, if you look into it, they find that the FDA themselves find we should not have given this emergency use authorization. But we're going to move on with Robert's permission because the battle lines are drawn anyway. There are a good 50% of the U.S. adult population who are never going to get this clot shot, regardless of what anybody says. And it's the same here in France, and it's about to get violent here in France. Not because of the protesters, it's because that's clearly their agent provocateur. But let us get back to water. Let's get back to the miracle of water. So essentially, what we have discovered is that about 11% of the activity of the brain is quantum, because water is a dipole. You've got the oxygen being seriously separated from the two hydrogens. So that creates a dipole effect, and you get a lot of quantum effects as a result of that, because there are a lot of spare electrons floating around. So the calculation, and I recommend again that people look at our papers, bionoetics.org, bioenergetics.org. Find our papers there and find my papers and the others, which point to the fact that brain function is about 11% quantum, around 89% classical, and that it's due to the fact that, as Robert pointed out, water is critical to us, who we are, and to consciousness itself. Robert.
Yes, since we broached the subject again of COVID, there are some good news. I received a call today from our friend Peter in Florida, who informed me that his son caught COVID this week and that he was feeling quite miserable, but he kept going to work, and that when he tested him, and there are home tests now, you can test yourself. According to Peter, he says that Walgreens has marketed a test. You don't have to report it to anybody. You can test yourself. So he tested his son, and his son had come down with COVID, and that he uses something called monolaurin, which is an antiviral supplement. And he gave it to his son, and his son, when he gave him these tablets of monolaurin, which has lauric acid, which has been shown to kill cancers in vitro, he gave it to his son, and his son immediately went into, he said, one of the most painful body experiences, painful somatic experiences he'd ever had, but that in 3 hours, the whole thing broke. He was free of symptoms in 3 hours as a result of his father's use of monolaurin to treat COVID. In Florida and elsewhere, the government has been lying to the public about the severity of the so-called Delta variant. I found out a couple of interesting things. The CDC has been touting this inflammatory statistic, saying three times as many people are dying from the Delta variant, unvaccinated people are dying from the Delta variant as opposed to the vaccinated people. I found out two interesting things. The percentage of people who are actually dying is 0.09%, less than 1%. So when they're talking about three times as many dying, it's one of the most gross exaggerations you've ever heard, because you realize you're talking about a minuscule part of the population. The other thing is they've been releasing statistics about Florida, and last week they were caught faking statistics. They put out a statistic that 28,000 people had been stricken by the Delta variant in Florida. All of this in order to smear Governor DeSantis. until the state of Florida took them to task and they had to reduce that number by half and admit that the 28,000 did not happen in one day, but it was over a whole week's period of time. So again, the fake statistics are being used to manipulate emotion, to create these dissonant waves in our brains, to create conflict amongst us. But I tell you, last night, seeing thousands of people just parading right through Central Park, arm in arm, shoulder to shoulder, no mask, happy as a lark, waving at my camera. I'm telling you, folks, the jig is up and the government better find out and admit it. We got rid of a really bad governor. I was on the radio this week with another program. I call into a leftist program. And the lady asked what I would remember about Governor Cuomo. Was there anything good that I would remember? I said, I'll never remember anything but the lockdown. And she said, why do you think they got rid of him this way? And I said, to keep the spotlight off his greater crimes, not just the 15,000 people that died in nursing homes, but the 40,000 people that died when he refused to give us access to hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, and other proven therapeutics. Now proven therapeutics, after a year of their employment, their use successfully around the world, particularly in India, hydroxychloroquine saving millions of people. And here, the CDC, Dr. Fauci, decreed that anyone who gave that to a patient would lose, any doctor would lose his license. And instead, Fauci, the FDA, and the CDC declared that the only treatment allowable for people who suffer COVID-19 was remdesivir. And remdesivir has been proven to be a killer, a kidney killer. So all of these people that were being forced to take remdesivir were dying of kidney failure. And the doctors in Washington were scratching their heads saying, you know, gee, this is the first time I've ever seen a virus that attacked the kidney so directly. Well, the virus didn't attack the kidney. Dr. Fauci and remdesivir attacked the kidneys to amplify the death rate. We are dealing with genocidal maniacs as bad as anything that existed in Nazi Germany. So let us stay alert. Let us not be cowed into fear. You have survived a year and a half. Those of you who are healthy and listening, those of you who didn't take the jab, the mark of the beast. As I've said, these people have hijacked every aspect of the end times theologies of Islam, Judaism, Christianity, and they have been stage managing global theatrics to force true these prophecies in their manner, in their way. And the mark of the beast is the famous one. It says that no one will be able to buy or sell or trade without having the mark of the beast. And when I tell people, you realize that they are injecting you with luciferase, luciferin, SM-102, and graphene oxide. That is the mark of the beast. Nothing could be more literal. So stay strong. Keep the faith. Faith in yourself. Faith in your wonderful immune system. My immune system is a miracle of creation. I am a descendant of someone who survived the Black Death, the Black Plague, the Spanish flu, the swine flu, everything. We've survived it all. And we are perfectly capable of transcending this. So
I look in this at the moment as the absolute failure of taxpayer funded science. I mean, when this came along, there should have been a public debate in every country. I mean, every country pays their scientists fortunes. I'm totally independent, by the way. I don't get any money from anybody. But basically, the science budget worldwide is in the trillions. And there was not one single decent debate among scientists about the epidemiological model, which is basically... The epidemiological model, so-called, runs as follows. Lock them up. That's it. That's the model. You know, it came from 1927. And so there was no debate about that. There was no debate about the fatalities. The fatalities are a minute fraction of what they're claiming that they were, and that's increasingly clear at the moment. That's if you believe in COVID-19 at all, which a lot of good scientists do not. They don't think it exists. They think that it's basically, essentially just the flu. And because the number of duplications is up to 45, in the PCR tests, of course, they found what they were looking for. I need people who didn't listen last week. Here it goes again. The CDC admitted that they did not have any sample of SARS-CoV-2 when they produced their PCR test. So consequently, they just used a library of old RNA viruses that they had. Now, I'm sorry, folks, that you have to pick up so much science so quickly, but you do. So basically, what the CDC are basically saying, that SARS-CoV-2 is an RNA virus, and we don't have a sample of it. But hey, look, our library here, we've got a whole bunch of RNA viruses related to respiratory events. So let's use those instead. If you took a PCR test for COVID-19, you were not tested for COVID-19. You were tested for some mixture of colds and flu. Now, you can, as we did, predict the number of supposed cases of COVID-19 that will happen. We managed to do that, and we communicated with a lot of state authorities, including North Dakota, saying we can predict your cases, and here they are for the next 19 days. And the North Dakota authorities had no interest in this. All they were interested in doing was locking you up, folks. Now, Robert, I was hoping to get a chance to talk about God tonight, because I do not want to get typecast as this angry Irishman who appears on your show every week. Can we move on?
Of course, I'd love to talk about it. I just want to add one more thing about the deceptions of the CDC. In their breakdown of vax versus unvaxxed people, they've got a new classification. If a person comes down with COVID who received the jab, they are no longer considered vaccinated people. So that's another skewing of the statistics. Just a short note, my sympathies to Kansas Elementary School teacher Josiah Enyart. He decided to quit his job as a school teacher at the Shawnee Mission School District in Kansas. And the school board has fined him a liquidation penalty of $1,000 for resigning after a specific deadline in the contract. That's how far they're going, folks. They are desperate. And the more you quit, the more you say no, the sooner this thing will be over. They Amen. Cannot replace Amen. Everybody. And yes, let's talk to God.
Amen. I totally agree. So, my name, by the way, is spelled Nuallallain. I just say that because people may want to look up the books that I've written in the past on the web. And the most recent one was a book called Follow the Sun, about COVID-19, and we were the first people to be able to predict transmissions. And we were right. We got the whole thing right, except that we were just a little bit naive in that we thought that what the transmissions were of COVID-19. They weren't. They were just of random RNA cold and flu viruses. So forgive us that one, but we got the rest of it right. So I'm just about to publish another book called the new one, Reality, Beauty, and the Sacred. And we're just in the middle of a coup d'etat attempt by plutocrats. It's not working. They made a mistake. They thought that basically they could manipulate people like Macron, this little boy here in France, who is president of a very badly constructed republic. They thought they could manipulate him into implementing their plan. And the problem with that is that France is a country like the United States, which teaches civics to kids, and they are told to pride themselves on their autonomy and their republican citizenship. And Americans have a lot of guns, and the government dare not move past certain lines in the sand. In France, there are up to 10 million people on the street on Saturday, so it's basically over. But my issue in this book, which will be out in a month, was essentially we have just witnessed a plutocrat attempted coup d'etat. It came perilously close. Those of us who know Bill Gates saw his fingerprints all over this. Establish a standard, find the relevant players, and get them to implement standards like the appalling Microsoft products over the years. And now the response to COVID-19, a bad statistical model, a bad model of how it came to be, and so on. So what we need to respond with is something of the notion of how sacred it is to be a human being, how sacred this cosmos is, how sacred Gaia is, how sacred are the terms by which we as conscious beings live on a planet. And then we find our whole being is a miracle. The power of negative gravity, the power that would tear us apart, is 10 to the power of 120 times less than it should be, according to the calculations. This is the worst prediction ever in science, according to everybody. And yet it is true. We should not exist. The fine structure constant, the ratio of the mass to the electron and the proton, all of these are totally biased in favor of our existence. One of the greatest skeptics for this line of reasoning, Fred Hoyle, who believed in the steady state universe, actually proved that the transition from beryllium to carbon contained two resonances which were totally and utterly unpredictable, and which yet led to our existence as carbon-based beings. So we know one thing about ultimate reality: it wants carbon-based beings here. We know many other things about it, about the, if you consider ultimate reality as the wave function of the cosmos, fair enough, but we know in any case, it's, as we said at the start of this program, it's vehemently interconnected. We know that after Entanglement and John Bell, it's vehemently interconnected. We also know from the start of this program, it's noetic. It's basically our observation has results in the universe. And more than that, we have all these platonic forms like pi, square root of minus one, the circle, all of these things, which are somehow embedded in everything that we are. It's evolving. It likes to go to the edge of chaos. And so this kind of notion of stability is one of the great mistakes of all time. It's in the absolute essence of physical nature to go to the edge of chaos. Even in the brain, the brain does not try and conserve energy. It just tries and makes its experience as plural as possible, as diverse as possible, at whatever energetic cost. And brain cells consume more energy by many orders of magnitude than any other organ in the body. So we know certain things about the absolute. It seems to want to know itself through us, and you don't have to believe in God to know that. or to assert that. I mean, Carl Sagan, who was pretty much a dogmatic atheist, says that that's basically what we are. We, as humans, are a way for the cosmos to know itself. So what the new book is about is in particular an emanationist scenario. We come from this undifferentiation of subject and object. One of the problems of our previous experiences of God, or of our previous hypotheses of God, was that God was this ultimate subject who was self-aware. And what we know about ultimate reality at this stage, it is not self-aware. Its self-awareness is us. We are its act of self-awareness. We, in all our tiny yet universally significant struggles, we are God attempting to know itself through the world. And every single religion that ever existed and lasted any length of time acknowledged that we are incredibly important. And so as Bill Gates tries to kill off 15% of the world's population, as he said to a TED talk in 2010, we say to him, no, we will not let you do that because every one of us is important and we will kill you rather than allow you to do that. So essentially, we take what we know about ultimate reality, this Ouroboros, it's beyond subject and object, it's evolving, it's noetic, it's entangled, and we can project onto it what scholastic theologians thought about God. For them, God was absolute. God was a source of being. God is eternal. God is ubiquitous. And all of these are actually correct, but there is a third step. And the third step is the one I'm most interested in. It's the third step that basically allows creative people who know how to do ritual, who know how to do sacrament. It's the third step that allows these people to create a religion. And it's to assert that there is a moral purpose to our existence. That, in fact, all these coincidences which created us were acts of will. And that we have to respond with our own wills. We have to, on the one hand, accept that, and we accept this with great joy, that we are in touch with the source of being, with every sensation that we have. But we also are moral creatures, and our morality is how we get to know reality on the social level. And so what is happening to us now is obviously completely unacceptable. And even people who don't know science are actually getting out on the street and saying, no, 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 I am not going to do this. I don't care. So for them, it's essentially an instinct. But for the rest of us who've had the privilege of some education, particularly people like Robert and myself, who had the great privilege of a Jesuit education, I think we should take some time to look at what a completely new Weltanschauung, a completely new worldview would look like. Something that insists that we are necessary here. Something that says that essentially we take a God as absolutely forgotten as El, the God that Muhammad used, and we say that this is the source of being, that this is the meaning of everything that we are. Or we take Moses with each burning bush, Abraham, or we take whatever. But we have the courage to say that these plutocrats are not ever going to attempt to do anything like this again, because we are sacred. We are luminous beings.
Yes, indeed.
Robert.
Yes. I was struck, you know, I agree that we are instruments of God learning to know himself. And the image that came to me as a metaphor was you or I looking through a microscope or a telescope to get a deeper insight into the microscopic world or into the cosmos. And that perhaps that is what we are as individual beings. We are the microscopes and telescopes of God, whereby he is able to enter a realm from which spirit is excluded. I think that the sensorium is open only to instrumentalities that can sense, and sense in a carnal way. The other thing I'm struck with, the beauty of the universe and the goodness of God and the concept of free will. Everybody wants law and order. But I tell you, without chance and without chaos, there would be no free will. If there were no chance, you see, I think Einstein was trying to create a domino theory of reality, that everything was perfectly timed and concatenated, like a string of dominoes, cause and effect, basically. But the fact is that because there is chance in the universe and there is chaos in the universe, those two elements innately provide the field for free will, because we as human beings, we can take a chance, right? We can risk, take a chance, and change the outcome. And the second one is we can look upon chaos and decide to bring order into chaos, or to break it into smaller chaotic events and reorganize it so that it is not ultimately totally destructive to life and social order.
So if you look at our website, bioneetics.org, you'll find papers by Henry Stapp, for example. So Henry was a student of Segre, Heisenberg, and Pauli, and worked very intensively with John Wheeler, all these guys are Nobel laureates. So Henry is still alive, well into his 90s at this point. So he put his immense ability to the task of saying that free will has to exist, because the original choice of what you observe is a completely free choice. And then the choice that nature makes, that the observation is ended, is a completely free choice. So that actually was Henry's work with us. I had another epiphany when I worked with a French student who wanted to do a PhD on the relationship between science and art. So we found that the special relativity, Einstein basically says that the space and time has to be relative to each observer. And Picasso and Braque worked that through in Cubism explicitly, but even before special relativity, Picasso had intimated that in Les Demoiselles d'Avignon. And so we found the same thing again in the stream of consciousness ideas in the novel, Joyce, Virginia Woolf, and so on. And thirdly, in composers like Xenakis, we continued through chaos theory that Robert just pointed out there, and we found that people like Philip Glass had been using chaos theory explicitly, Jackson Pollock. And finally, quantum mechanics, we found that in the 20th century, writers like Joyce had turned the act of reading into an act of context determination, which is pretty much what John Wheeler said to Henry Stapp is what quantum observation is. Now, what we intuited from all of this is that there is an underlying reality which is common to both science and art. In the arts, we are attempting to create a subjective state. We are attempting to create something that there is something it is like to be in that state, a qualia, those words come to that. In science, we're attempting to establish a fact. But in either case, it's ultimate reality knowing itself through us. And I believe that we need people who are talented in ritual, sacrament, to shape the victory that we're about to have over Bill Gates, the World Economic Forum, which already shows signs of surrendering, by the way. If you check their website, the World Economic Forum, they're now saying you don't need a PCR test after all. A saliva test is sufficient. That came up on their site yesterday. So we need somebody, we need people, we need a team to shape this victory so that something like this, something as horrible as this, what we have been confronting through all this summer, will never happen again. Robert.
Yes, yes, indeed. You know, I intuit from what you said with the World Health Forum, et cetera. What we're going to see now is a face-saving campaign.
Exactly.
As I said, we've exposed anti-science and demonstrated what a fraud it has been for the last 50-something years. But now they are going to try everything in their power to save face and to try to explain away why we were mistaken. We cannot accept their authority ever again. We must reject it once and for all. I would like to just say quickly in the last minute, I've been telling the audience that there's a mystery as to why certain people succumb so quickly to the vaccine, to the jab, and other people seem to be getting along. I've said that I suspected that because the jab is so similar to HIV, how HIV AIDS invades the body, I know for a fact that certain groups of people, certain blood types that had a blood type CD4 had succumbed, while people who had the blood factor CD8 thrived and do not die. They have an asymptomatic form of AIDS. Well, I have a Dr. Bruce Patterson who has validated my theory, and he has observed that in the reactions of people with to the jab, that people who are surviving are the ones that have the lowest levels of CD8 and then rebuild the CD8 blood factor, which is super killer T cells, cytotoxic killer T cells. And he says that there is a drug that can enhance the expression of CD8. So he's been using an alternative form of therapy. He's actually been repressing this immune system reaction. More on that next week. Thank you for joining us. Good night, everyone. And tune in tomorrow at 10 o'clock for the Living Water Project on the right stuff.
Still out there?
You're going back in?
There's still men out there. God damn. When I go home, people ask me, "Hey, Hoot, why do you do it, man? Why? You some kind of war junkie?" I won't say a goddamn word. Why? They won't understand. They won't understand why we do it. They won't understand it's about the men next to you. And that's it. That's all it is.
Revolution Radio. Freedomslips.com. Number one listener-supported radio. The printing press for freedom at a time when freedom is needed the most.
All right. Thanks for listening while we take that short break here at Revolution Radio, freedomslips.com. And yeah, we're going to get back to your host.